KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Shama Sawant is the first socialist on Seattle's city council. Last year, she ran on a campaign platform of raising the minimum wage to $15, taxing the wealthy, and rent control. She spoke with The Stranger's Charles Mudede about why now is the time for socialism in Seattle. This talk was recorded at Town Hall on March 18th, 2014.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to our event tonight. My name is Deepa, and I'm going to be the moderator this evening. So I'm going to pose some questions to Charles and Shama, and we're going to have a conversation up here for about 40 minutes. I'm going to be the timekeeper. And after our conversation, we will open the stage up for audience question and answer and comment. So I'll let you know when that time is coming. But before that, I'd like to ask Shama and Charles some questions about our topic today, which is why socialism and why now? So why is it that socialism is important? How is it relevant for us today here in Seattle? So my first question is to Shama. I want to start by talking about the $15 an hour campaign. And I'm curious why $15 an hour is such a central issue for you. You could focus on other things. You could focus on a basic income. You could focus on trying to raise revenue to restore some of our social services. So why $15 an hour? Why is this so important right now?
Thank you, Deepa, and thank you, Charles. Thanks for this opportunity to have this very important conversation. And I think that's a very important question. Why 15? We could be doing so many things. And I'm sure those of you who were tuned into our campaign for city council last year noticed that on our campaign flyer, we talked about a $15 an hour minimum wage for Seattle. We also talked about affordable housing and rent control and taxing the wealthy for funding for mass transit and education. And the reality is that for decades, the vast majority of the people, not only in the U.S. but around the world, have seen declining living standards. It's been a very systematic process of a decline in living standards, a decline in any political voice, and it's been a race to the bottom. So you could pick any issue out of a hat, and that would be an important issue because that's how much the backslide has been, how pronounced it has been. But the fact is that winning social gains and a fight for social justice is not simply a matter, it's not a linear equation of what, there's no way you could just line up all these different demands that we need to fight for and arrive at some sort of consensus that this is more important than the other. No, housing is in crisis in Seattle. You know, affordable housing is in an extreme crisis everywhere in the country, and healthcare is in huge crisis. So I could go on and on. We could spend the entire evening talking about the different crises we face, but political change works in a somewhat different way. Political change requires people to become part of an organized movement from below in order to put pressure on the top, because the way the capitalist economy and society and political system functions, wealth is what determines your political power. So while the elite, the 1%, so-called 1%, as Occupy stated, have a very, very consolidated political power, and they have successfully throttled so many of grassroots efforts, the only way to counter that is not by billions, because we don't have those billions. What we do have is billions of people who are suffering under the system. And so the only way you can really push for social change is if you can mobilize large numbers of people to fight around a demand, to organize around a demand. And it just so happens that the $15 an hour demand has captivated the imagination of a large number of low-wage workers all around the nation, starting with the fast food workers in New York City, who very courageously walked out in 2012, in the fall of 2012, with a demand of 15 and a union. And I want everybody to understand how much courage it takes as a low-wage worker, where you have nothing, no financial or social cushion. All you have is your job, your crappy job, but that's all you have. And when you walk out and you take on the possible retaliation and firing, but you do that, you take your life into your own hands and walk out, that is a powerful statement. And because of that, starting with that, $15 an hour really became the epicenter of everything. We had SeaTac, we had our campaign, and a lot of this momentum centering around that demand. But the reality is that the struggle for 15 is not only the struggle for a substantial increase in the living wage, it really captures everything that people are angry about, the overall social and economic injustice. And our hope as socialists is that we not only win a really strong 15, but we have what we would at the end of it have mobilized a mass movement in Seattle that is an inspiration not only to itself, but to workers all around the nation, and develop a base that can actually push for a deeper social change that goes well beyond $15 an hour.
Okay. So I think one of the big criticisms that has been raised against this $15 an hour increase is what it will do to small businesses. And I'm curious, especially for Charles. So Charles is our urbanist here, our devotee of the city, right? So he's here to defend the city of Seattle. He's a writer for The Stranger to defend the character of Seattle. Will raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour change the character of our city? Will it get rid of those little coffee shops and bars and pubs that can't afford to pay their workers $15 an hour? And will we just look like a suburb where all we have are big businesses like Starbucks that can actually afford to maybe pay their workers $15 an hour?
I would love to answer this question. Only because I sort of cannot disagree with increasing the minimum wage. It's almost impossible for me to take that position. And then, of course, I'm not a person who has faced the difficulties of living on the minimum wage. And I'm not also finally a business person living on the minimum wage. But what I do know is that we live in a city with roughly a $200 billion gross domestic product, right? We generate about $200 billion a year in this region, which is comparable. I mean, it squashes anything that's even heard of. It's half of South Africa entirely with 40 million people. And it's hard for me when we talk about the little shops to separate the wealth that is so apparent in this city. And so to me, we're not addressing this other thing as to how is this even an issue when you consider the amount of money that is around us every day, and we act like it's not there, and we talk about coffee shops, and we don't talk about the fact that they did a test, I think I remember this, and they did a thing where they were looking, there's a funny little economic thing that they did. And what they were trying to find out was whether, which regions propped up the entire economy during the 90s. Because they found out the whole of the United States was not doing very well. It was, so the numbers that you were sort of, during the Clinton era of prosperity that we sort of admire and say, and look back at, when you look at like, where was this wealth actually being generated, it was like a few counties in the entire United States of America. And King County was numbered among these counties. Others were doing badly or just getting by. So it's a stunning thing to me when you look at King County as representative of some of the greatest wealth known on this earth that we have a debate of this kind. That's my position.
Okay, Shama, would you like to respond?
First of all, I think we should remember that regardless of the size of the company that employs you, your cost of living is no different. And that should be our starting point. How much do people need to be able to live a decent life, a dignified existence, where you're not constantly worried about whether the check that you wrote for your rent is going to bounce because you had to purchase urgent health care or something like that. You know, that's the kind of brink that a lot of households live on. But with that starting point, we can also understand why it is that we need a larger conversation about how this can be made. So let's assume that for a moment that those apocalyptic scenarios that people are telling you about were to come true. They won't, but let's assume that they were to. What are we saying? What statement does that make about the system? It's telling you that this system is so fragile and dysfunctional that if all these poverty-stricken workers, you know, this is the working poor we're talking about, people who work endlessly and don't make enough to put food on the table, this system is so dysfunctional that if the economy were to give something close to a living wage to its working poor, it's going to collapse. If that were true, my response to that is, well, then that system should be completely rejected. Why are we trying to save it? It's an indefensible argument, and we should be bold enough to state that correctly. But having said that, I think we should take a step back and understand how the capitalist system works as far as, you know, small businesses are concerned. A political scientist, you know, Michael Parenti, once said that small businesses are like squirrels dancing in the middle of elephants. And I feel bad using that metaphor because I love elephants. But it gets the point across that inherently this system is not set up to look out for small businesses. For every small business that you see that has survived, you know, the storefront, there are dozens that you will never know about because they never saw the light of day, because the obstacles to setting up a small business are so high. The capital investment, you know, the rent, finding the, you know, the startup goods that you need, finding somebody to back you. It's incredible how difficult it is. 6 out of 10 small businesses close down because it's so difficult. And finally, the reason that small businesses are suffering today as we speak is not because workers are being paid a living wage. They are suffering at the same time that workers are being paid a poverty wage. And there's a simple relationship. Local businesses depend on local customers to survive. And one of the big reasons why the businesses are struggling is because there isn't a customer base that can actually have the disposable income to buy the goods here. In fact, economists will tell you, research indicates that when low-wage workers get money in their pockets, they spend all of it, and they spend all of it in the local economy because they don't get to fly to Paris for a fancy vacation. They're going to spend it here. They're going to buy their kids ice creams. They might buy little trinkets for themselves. They might go to the restaurant. They might buy a car, finally, because they need it. You know, that's the sort of thing we have to understand. So if we are concerned about small businesses, then it's absolutely critical that we move towards all the workforce getting a living wage, because that is a starting point. But we should not stop there. We have to talk about taxing the rich and big business in order to make sure that struggling small businesses and nonprofit human services can be funded.
Shama Sawant and Charles Mudede. They spoke at Town Hall on March 18th, 2014. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of this talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Charles Mudede and Shama Sawant in a moment, 920, 94.9 KUOW. Later tonight, we're going to hear a conversation with the first poet laureate of Jamaica since its independence from Britain in 1962. That'll be during the 11 o'clock hour tonight. In an effort to improve medical care, a group of hospitals, clinics, and insurers is pooling patient data. Later tonight, a conversation about the promise and perils of sharing individual patient records. That's the Diane Rehm Show tonight at midnight. Forecast for the Seattle area for tonight, lows lower to mid-40s, breezy, showers likely this evening, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers after midnight. Friday highs around 60, partly sunny skies. Support for KUOW comes from Seattle pediatrician Dr. Robert Pretlow, currently recruiting 30 overweight youth ages 10 to 20 to participate in a study of a new smartphone app in a guided weight loss program. More information and qualifying criteria at patientecare.com/study.
KUOW and Book It Repertory Theater present local author Jim Lynch's Truth Like the Sun, April 23rd through May 18th at the Center Theater. A Seattle raconteur who ran the World's Fair runs for mayor decades later as a reporter digs into his past. More on the events page at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Shama Sawant is the first socialist on Seattle's city council. Last year, she ran on a campaign platform of raising the minimum wage to $15, taxing the wealthy, and rent control. She spoke with The Stranger's Charles Mudede about why now is the time for socialism in Seattle. This talk was recorded at Town Hall on March 18th, 2014.
I would like to turn the conversation towards the S word, which is a good word for tonight, socialism. So the alternative that you are kind of skirting around is socialism, right? That's the alternative that you envision. What is socialism to you? What does that mean? What does that look like? How is it different from capitalism? How would it be different from what we see right now?
What we see right now is a good starting point to understand what socialism is. And actually, Deepa, she was referencing something that she and I talked when she interviewed me during the campaign, and she made a good point that, you know, it's stunning that you're actually so free with the word capitalism, and that's a very good point because, you know, often people say, wow, you have the guts to call yourself a socialist and, you know, use the S word. And I often point out that a more remarkable thing is to use the C word, because naming the system is important. Otherwise, we are left with this mystical idea that this is the economy, meaning this is the only way an economy, a human economy, can be designed, you know, meaning on capitalist lines, and there is no other alternative. It's a very subtle thought control thing that happens when you think of this as the economy. The moment you step out from that and say that this is the capitalist economy, that opens up the possibility of an alternate to capitalism. And I think that's why it's important for us to point out relentlessly that this is the capitalist economy that we're talking about. What do we see under capitalism? I mean, look at Occupy's message, you know. Occupy crystallized it in some ways. You know, it said 1% versus the 99%. In a very pithy slogan, they captured the class conflict, meaning capitalism is a system that works only for a tiny minority, global minority. Capitalism is a global system, and it works such that a tiny global minority gains untold amounts of wealth and power at the expense of the rest of humanity. Socialism is the complete opposite of that. Socialism would be an economy and a society that would be organized such that the goal of the economy would not be to enrich a small minority at the cost of everyone else, instead to provide a very high standard of living, to harness all the abilities of society and technology to provide a very high standard of living to everybody on the planet in an environmentally sustainable manner. But this cannot happen in a vacuum. Meaning what? Meaning that we, as far as technology is concerned, as far as the resources and science is concerned, our society today is fully capable of not only satisfying the basic needs of everybody, but satisfying them in a very high-quality manner. But it's not going to happen without political changes. And what is that political change that is different about socialism? Socialism, unlike capitalism, is a democratically organized global economy where not only the resources, but the decisions of how to use those resources, how to organize society, are in the hands of the, you know, the mass of people, not in the hands of a small elite, which is what capitalism is. So if we want to go towards socialism, we have to understand that it will require a massive political shift in our thinking and in the way government is organized, in the way the economy is organized. So, you know, people often think about co-ops. People also know about some of the worker-controlled factories in countries like Argentina. That's a small example. That's a microcosm of what could be possible under a socialist economy. But socialism cannot be brought about in one city or in one country. It has to be a global system, but I can talk more later if you want.
Well, Charles, maybe I can pose this question to you. So, okay, so, you know, Chama, you brought up some of these examples, these examples of worker control that exist today in Argentina, co-ops, for example. But what about the experiments of the 20th century, the socialist or communist experiments of the 20th century? Are these examples of socialism? So maybe, Charles, you know, you come from... Yeah, from a place, from a country that attempted this. And is that socialism to you?
I had front row seats on this experiment. And it's not a... The question was really complicated. And no matter what... I don't want to get into Zimbabwe because that's a really long discussion. But you have to go and see what was going on in the 1970s. The Lancaster Agreement. The issue with the farm, the land, which was not resolved. And also there's an issue with Zimbabwe's involvement in the UN in a rotating seat for the Security Council. And all those things meant that whatever socialist interests that they had were not really available in any realistic way. And you have to then skip a little bit later to a desperate situation where the government feels like it's being excluded out of the world market and so forth and so on. And then the IMF appears and says, well, and this is the 20th century as far as I'm concerned, and says, well, look, what you have to do is this, you Africans, if you want to be rich like us Americans and so forth and so on, and Europeans, this is how we did it. We, first of all, and it was called ESAP, it was called Economic Structural Adjustment Program. Right. This was imposed, and it still is imposed. In fact, Greece is going through this right now. It's sort of funny to see this happening now. I don't want to get into that, but it was called ESAP. IMF said, and was said to Zimbabwe, said that you guys are struggling, and we weren't doing that badly in the 80s. We weren't, weirdly enough. But they said, if you want to do better than what you're doing right now, you have to follow this prescription. And this prescription is like how we do it in the USA. And that was called Economic Structural Adjustment Program. And it became known amongst Africans when it was imposed as extra suffering for African people. because what they said is you liberalize your economy, you drop capital controls, capital can go in and out, right? You cut state spending, which all sounds very familiar, right? And then you privatize whatever can be privatized, and all this stuff, and that's what they did. And the economy tanked. And in fact, any country that sort of took on this program saw no development at all. They used to talk about Chile as being the example of what, so forth and so on, but said, oh, so we need a dictator to make this work. But, you know, Pinochet, all right, fine, we'll do that. But that's what they did. And so, in the face of, like, the socialist attempt, which failed against the neoliberal direction in the 90s, which absolutely was a catastrophe of the first order. And this is why I say this is the 20th century. You have to go back and question. And so I want to say one quick thing before I get into this, because when we talk about the alternative, we're talking about Margaret Thatcher. And what did, that was her. She said there's no alternative. And I love old Maggie, dead Maggie. And, and she said this, and it was understood. And what we sort of like faced with at this time, and when we're thinking about socialism, is that we sort of like forgotten, like, that what they were doing in the 70s, Margaret Thatcher, Ronnie, the Volcker Shock, all of this stuff. And even Jimmy Carter, I mean, as much as we love him, Jimmy Carter is the one who gave us Paul Volcker. And anybody wants to talk about the Volcker Shock, that was under a Democratic leader, right? The interest rates and the catastrophe meant for places like Mexico. I mean, just look at it. There was not a Republican. Reagan just danced right into what was already set up by a Democratic leader. He didn't get rid of Volcker. He stayed in power as the federal, as the head of the Federal Reserve. So when you look at what's happened, what Margaret Thatcher and all these guys did, essentially, was an attack on the working class. It was a class attack, and we sort of forgotten about this. And so suddenly we end up like, oh well. Because we sort of believe that things get better and we believe in progress, we're suddenly like, okay, so what do we have available to us? And then we say, like, we can't talk about socialism because that's an old thing. And we forget that what they did essentially was attack something that was all, you know, that had come up several times. It was there in the 20s. It was there in the 1840s. And suddenly it's just like no use to us all of a sudden. And this is, to me, the big problem I have. Is like, of course it's still useful. And of course labor unions are still useful. I mean, we shouldn't act as that the world moves in stages of improvement. There's actually things that are solid. I'll just say one last thing as an urbanist. We often talk about, like, cars were supposed to be this progressive thing, and it's supposed to make a city better and richer, and now we see that it's making people unhealthy and so forth and so on, and that what's really useful is what we did 100 years ago, which was walk to places in cities. So I'm just saying that socialism was attacked, and we've forgotten that there's a good reason to attack it, and it's not that it was wiped out, and it can be revived and continued in today. That's my point.
Okay, but I still want to pose this more critical question to both of you as socialists. I guess you are both proclaimed socialists. What about the state? And looking back at the history of the 20th century, we did see a lot of evil, death, and destruction committed in the name of socialism, right? National socialism. Some of you may remember that, and its final solution, right? So I think, how does socialism think about the state? How does socialism think about the power of the state? Is your brand of socialism, is the type of socialism that either of you envision, could it go to that totalitarian place? Is that something that we should be afraid of here in the United States when we have our first socialist city council member in Seattle? Right?
Thanks. I would say, first of all, that if people are wondering about death and destruction, first of all, we need look no further than what has been happening under capitalism. Decades of death and destruction. It is true that, economies like the former Soviet Union, which I would call a very distortion of an idea of socialism, they were really, what they evolved into were what I would call a, bureaucratic dictatorship. So when you're talking about socialism and referencing the former Soviet Union, for example, what you're referencing is what it turned into, which I would call Stalinism. And that's not what we're talking about. And while it's true that the Stalinist regime was repressive and there were huge issues, there's no question about that. But I would first start by counterposing it to the absolute misery that the capitalist system unleashes on the vast majority of people on the planet. And, we are here in the U.S. This is the wealthiest country in the history of humanity. And one in six people is poor, by census numbers. And actual poverty is far, far bigger, far higher than that. And the violence of having to live a life of homelessness, of sexual exploitation, of sexual violence, of the repression of the LGBT community. I mean, there's an enormous suffering that is unleashed on the population. This is the U.S. we're talking about. We're not even talking about what capitalism does to other countries around the globe, like India or countries in Africa, in the African continent. And in fact, if people want to see what capitalism actually does, you should look at capitalist Nigeria, capitalist India, capitalist Indonesia, to see the scale and magnitude of just absolute poverty and degradation that is forced upon people. But it is absolutely also a correct question to ask, what was it that in the former Soviet Union, was that socialist? Do we have any compelling examples of socialism around us? Those are the good questions to ask. These are good, this is a good starting point. Is Sweden socialist? These are questions that people have in their minds, and I think it's good to bring them out. And it's important to recognize that a lot of the gains that were made by countries like Sweden, Norway, the Nordic countries, by Europe, by the European continent in general, were it was a direct consequence, it was a direct byproduct of struggles towards socialism, of struggles by the labor movement. And so when people think that there's something very, you know, wonderful about Sweden and Finland, how come they have funding for education, there's something wrong about the U.S., you know, look to the history of labor struggles, and many of these labor struggles were led by socialists, and a lot of the gains that were made in that era, you know, in the 20s, 30s, 40s, were incomplete. So they didn't lead to actual socialist economies, but they led to a huge effort to take some of the gains of productivity and make them available in the form of education, housing, healthcare, and other things that you need to just have a basic life. And a lot of those happened not because of capitalism, they happened in spite of capitalism. And so we have examples of those, of what things you can have in a socialist economy when you look at some of these countries, but they're all capitalist countries. They're what I would call social democracies, meaning they're capitalist countries which have a much more extended welfare state, much more extended social programs. But if you look at what's happening to Europe today, Europe is hardly a poster child for what an economy should look like today. Europe is in massive and deep crisis today. A lot of these programs that were fought for by labor activists, by socialists, you know, making enormous sacrifices, personal lives were given to these struggles, and all of that is now unraveling in Europe because capitalism is incapable of really providing for those needs. And what's happening now is what you will see after any really massive recession under capitalism. Recessions are written into the DNA of capitalism, and every time you have a massive one like the one that's just happened, all the programs, reforms that were fought for in the past will get lost because of the assault, you know, what's called the austerity program by capitalists. So what we have to understand is that those are some of the things we are striving for, but there is no real example of socialist economy or socialist country around the world, precisely because it is impossible for one country to be an island of socialism. You cannot have a socialist economy that survives on itself. That's not possible. You need an exchange of resources. You need that to happen on a global scale. So just like capitalism is a global system today, socialism will only be able to survive if there is a global push towards socialism. Of course, it has to start somewhere, but unless that happens, we will not be able to do that. And that is, and I won't be able to go into the history of why the beginnings of the genuine workers' revolution in Russia turned into Stalinism, but just to quickly, you know, summarize that by saying that there were beginnings of what could be what could have been a socialist economy. However, it didn't quite work out that way because of various reasons, not the least of which was a very concerted and conscious attack by many capitalist countries, including the United States, on that new sort of budding socialist government that was coming up, because it's a question of people's consciousness. You know, what can be achieved in terms of social change is not something mechanical. It's a question of whether people feel afraid to fight for massive social change, or they feel fearless and they're willing to make a sacrifice. So really, what we can achieve is a question of what our morale is, what our confidence is. And so if there were a successful example of a socialist economy anywhere on the planet, I guarantee you that working people everywhere will look at that and say, that is what I want, and it will inspire global struggles. And that is precisely what the 1917 Russian Revolution did. It inspired struggles all around the world. The whole wave of colonial revolutions, including in my home country, India, was a direct consequence of the inspiration that it provided. But it's precisely because of that inspiration that it will be necessary for the capitalist class to, you know, try to crush it. So the only way we will be able to move, really make a shift away from capitalism, is if we have struggles everywhere and we have the idea of international working class solidarity. That is an absolute fundamental necessity if we are to move towards a socialist economy.
Shama Sawant and Charles Mudede. They spoke at Town Hall on March 18th, 2014. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of this talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Shama Sawant and Charles Mudede in a moment. 942, 94.9 KUOW. Tomorrow morning, we're going to hear a review of the week's news with Joni Balter of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel, Knut Berger of Crosscut.com and Seattle Magazine, and Eli Sanders of The Stranger. Topics of conversation could include Majority Leader Rodney Thom's departure from the state legislature, the continuing quest for a $15 an hour minimum wage, competing Washington state gun law measures that both have strong support, people being considered for Seattle Police Chief, and last-minute thoughts on Proposition 1 before Election Day. Prop 1 would increase sales taxes and car tab fees to fund Metro Transit and fix roads. It's all tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. Lows lower to mid-40s tonight, breezy, showers likely this evening. Mostly cloudy with a chance of showers after midnight. Friday highs around 60, partly sunny. Michael Feinstein's guest on Song Travels is actor-singer Cheyenne Jackson, beginning in a few minutes at 10 o'clock. Support for KUOW comes from Alaska Airlines, serving locally sourced food and beverages such as regionally craft-brewed beer and ale, spirits made on Capitol Hill, and cheese from Pike Place Market. More at alaskaair.com. Support for KUOW comes from Custom Pure, the water store, providing water filters for the kitchen and bath with home and office installation and service since 1981. Located in Shoreline and online at custompure.com.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Shama Sawant is the first socialist on Seattle's city council. Last year, she ran on a campaign platform of raising the minimum wage to $15, taxing the wealthy, and rent control. She spoke with The Stranger's Charles Mudede about why now is the time for socialism in Seattle. This talk was recorded at Town Hall on March 18th, 2014.
Okay, so I'd like to go back to this question of Sweden and the Scandinavian countries and social democracy, right? So you talked about how social democracy in the Scandinavian countries is, I mean, to some degrees it's failing, or at least it's dealing with a lot of difficulties. Western Europe, definitely. Is this because, you know, they did not pursue a full socialist path? Does socialism require that we nationalize everything? Is that kind of what it means to be a socialist? That we have collective control of all industries, all resources, whereas in the Scandinavian countries or other social democracies, you have collective control of some resources, some industries, and then you have corporate control or state control, right? These are mixed systems. So is a mixed system not going to work? Do we really have to move all the way to collectivization of all aspects of life? As a socialist, is that what you believe? Charles, why don't we start with you?
I'm going to say one quick thing before I take a chip at that one. Just to organize things. Now, I know that we just talked about the 20th century and socialism and its example being the barbarity of Soviet Union and all this stuff and what happened in other socialist experiments, communist experiments, so on and so on. But, you know, I'm always love this because everybody sort of talks about the document for capitalism, the founding document for capitalism, as being Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, right? And they always talk about the glorious invisible hand. But one thing they always seem to miss when you're reading that book, if you read it, and it's in several chapters, right, what they seem to miss is that slavery is alive and well. And this is capitalism. So we're talking about a document about capitalism that is discussing the exploitation of black labor for free from Africa at massive scales, at unprecedented scales. So when you're talking about the 20th century, it's a very limited view of what capitalism is about, right? You have to go a few more centuries back, and then it's revealed the other catastrophe, as large as the ones the ones we imagine in the 20th century, as impressive, as disastrous, and so forth and so on. So I never liked this idea of just talking about capitalism in 20th century. Let's talk about capitalism and its wider history. And in that sense, I don't think we have to be apologetic about the Soviet Union anymore. I mean, we have to like say, what about Brazil? You know, how did you get your sugar in your coffee? How did the working class in Europe get their, all these little delights that kept them working for in incredibly horrible situations? I mean, we seem to forget this other horrific aspect. Of capitalism and its development. That's one. The other one is, I don't think that for me, what's happened in Sweden has to be a kind of a truce between capital and labor. That is, I've always been ambiguous about that. I'm not a big fan of it entirely because it doesn't really strip away, for me at least, some of the really deep problems. If you look at what's going on in the Scandinavian countries, I mean, they still export military equipment as jets and so forth and so on. They're not paradises, right? They still export things that are not friendly, that are, and so forth and so on. So if you get about this other side of their economy and just look at what they're doing socially. And so to me, these structural things that have to be recognized. And then finally, with the Scandinavian socialism or social democracy, as it is called, I think that they have a huge dependence on. They say that they give their population a great education and so forth and so on, but I think that that's only in relation to being competitive in a global market. And so, in a sense, they're what the Marxists say, they're really dependent on what's called a relevance surplus value. They really are trying to, they're still playing the game. The question is, what would happen suddenly if that surplus value disappeared, which you get by having an educated class? What happens when that goes? Do you then just do you just revert? I mean, it could. It's not guaranteed at all. And the question that I have for those countries is, why is growth still necessary? Why do we still need to grow? And they still play the game of growth. And so to me, this is another problem about their socialism. And I'm against growth at the moment. I think that growth is a big problem because if you look at the USA, what are we doing? We still believe that we have to grow at 2 or 3% a year for everybody to be happy. And this is utter nonsense. We don't need growth anymore. And this is where if you're a socialist and you're talking about growth, I have deep problems with your socialism, because it's just like, we don't need it anymore.
We'll go to Shama for this last comment.
Just going off what Charles was saying, the historical underpinnings of capitalism, that it would not capitalism would not have evolved out of feudalism were it not for the massive exploitation and slavery and plundering of the resources. But I would say that that's not a historical thing. Capitalism cannot survive ever, even today, without an ongoing massive exploitation globally. So even if we were to suspend all facts for a second and imagine that Sweden was some sort of haven of social justice, which it isn't, but even if we were to imagine that, that's not coming without a price. There is no way that any technological development or growth, as Charles said, would happen anywhere in any developed country without an ongoing massive exploitation of their own workers, their most vulnerable workers, and of a plundering of resources everywhere on the planet. You know, every continent has been pillaged for resources and continues to happen, and there are newer waves of it. The thing that Charles referenced earlier, the neoliberal wave, the ESAP that he was talking about, that was the newer wave of the same capitalist system which was unleashing old but new sort of formulas of exploitation. Colonial revolutions were able to fight for a political independence, but the countries like India and like the countries in Africa never became economically independent, because such a thing is not possible while the global economy is being dominated by the capitalist class. So it's an independence in name, but then, you know, the exploitation comes in different ways. So you have now India, you know, can have our own, you know, prime minister who was born and brought up in India, but the economy itself is held hostage to global multinational corporations, some of which are of Indian origin. But that doesn't change the fact that there is an ongoing exploitation, and that's something that we have to never forget. But, you know, going to Deepa's question about what is it in Sweden, they've collectivized some resources, but maybe they haven't collectivized enough. Is that what it's going to take? I would say that the social democracies we're talking about, which were able to deliver what I would consider a middle-class standard of living to a larger group of people than happened in the United States, that is not really a result of any real collectivizing or democratic ownership of resources. That is a result of, as I said, you know, mass movements and labor movements that pushed for significant reforms. I wouldn't scoff at these reforms, but they were not actual. It did not involve taking the major corporations into the democratic ownership of the public at large or workers. What it did involve was massive reforms like taxing the wealthy, taxing profits, taxing corporate profits, making funds available by taxing the wealthy to enable a free, high-quality public education, to enable a national healthcare system. That is what happened, and those are massive reforms. I mean, today, if I could wake up tomorrow and have single-payer healthcare in the United States, that would be an enormous step forward from where we are today. But that is not collectivizing of resources. And if we are to genuinely move towards anything like a socialist economy, then it will require the largest resource basis, meaning all the oil corporations and the massive corporations, the multinationals, it will be necessary to take them into a democratic ownership by everybody, because otherwise we will not have a say in how resources are distributed, and that is key. That is key to determining what kind of economy we have. I mean, I'll give you a very simple, concrete example of what I'm talking about. We see untold levels of hunger and starvation and malnutrition all around the world. Malnutrition and hunger has gone up, not gone down. You know, every year the UN has a boilerplate program against hunger and starvation, but it's going up. But it's going up at the same time that wealth and productivity is going up. So the number of malnourished is going up while the number of billionaires is going up. That tells us that hunger and starvation and basic problems like that are not a consequence of any scarcity of resources, at least at this point in our society. It is a consequence of how wealth is distributed. And how wealth is distributed is a consequence of how wealth is owned in the first place, how that is organized. And that does need to be changed. But I can end by saying that if people are fear-mongering by saying, oh, your little corner shop is going to be taken control of by disorganized mobs, please recognize that as fear-mongering. The reality is that this economy that we have today, that is what we should be afraid of. You want to be afraid of something? Be afraid of where we are headed unless we fight against this race to the bottom, and unless we actually consciously participate in a process of social change, and that will require you to pick a side. It is a zero-sum game. You're not going to be able to devise a way in which you can benefit and Bill Gates can also benefit. Bill Gates owning the wealth of 20 equivalent to 23 countries' GDP is precisely the problem that we are facing, because wealth is in the hands of such few people that basic problems of humanity cannot be solved.
Shama Sawant and Charles Mudede. They spoke at Town Hall on March 18th, 2014. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of this talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the UW Medicine Eastside Specialty Center in Bellevue. Recently relocated and expanded, the center now provides more than 18 medical specialties, including urgent care and ultra-low-dose radiology. uwmedicine.org/eastside. Support for KUOW comes from PCC Natural Markets, welcoming the start of the local growing season with fresh organic fruits and vegetables arriving in-store from local farmers. With 9 neighborhood locations and a 10th store, Green Lake Village, opening June 4th. More at pccnaturalmarkets.com. And support for KUOW comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. 1 minute before 10, KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham. I'm Bill O'Grady. Tomorrow night, Poe Bronson, novelist and writer for television, radio, and the New York Times, Seattle singer-songwriter Iron Jones, and the Tea Sisters, a sister singing group from Oakland whose sound evokes 60s girl groups, and the Andrews Sisters, all recorded with a live audience in Portland, Oregon, tomorrow night at 8.
An extreme sports video, Living on the Streets.
Homeless individuals have, their own lives, and we don't yet have a great snapshot of what their daily experiences and interactions are.
Using GoPro cameras to document homelessness, some tech entrepreneurs try to upload empathy to an uncaring world. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Tomorrow morning at 9, KUOW is a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington. Thanks for being a member.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.